Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Yes, let's do that right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are going, this is the first Wednesday of the month, so it's Black Commentator Roundtable. And so we have one of our contributors, Bill Fletcher, and we're going to get to that in a minute. I want to go over a few little local announcements. And so if we run out of time, there'll be, you already have that. So the first thing is there was a new law that was just passed last week. And I'm going to put this on my website because it's an important one. There is now going to be voting rights for those people who've been on parole and probation. This is huge, y'all. And this is not some kind of a goodness on the part of the state. This has been a fight for a very long time for those of us who've been fighting for prisoner rights. So, and their disenfranchisement. So as of last week, now people that are on parole and probation, as long as it wasn't a violent crime or a crime dealing with sexual crimes, you can be voters now. The last day for registration in St. Louis is October 7th. So remember that and spread the word. And again, I'll put that up on our on the website so you have the little brochure that gives all the explanation. This is from the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition. So that's a celebration, y'all. That is a huge celebration because I think that's maybe about 41,000 people in Missouri that will be impacted by that law that will now be able to vote. So spread the word. This is National Suicide Month, and so we want to be aware of what that means and be aware of the people around us that may be under unnecessary and incredible stress just based on the political and economic situation that we are now in this country. Last week, or maybe now been 2 weeks, we launched the African American Suicide Awareness Initiative. And so you got to hear from a couple of the Black men who are providers of services for this particular sector of people, because we got to be concerned about our young people. You know, in many ways, we have not given them the tools they need to really navigate what we all are going through. Some grown folks can't even hardly navigate. Now, how do we expect our young people to do this? So we know there's been a dramatic increase in suicides of Black youth from 15 to 24, almost doubled since COVID. And so we are rallying our community regionally to address this. So you'll hear more about that in the future. But this whole month is just awareness of it. And so you might want to look at any activities that might be happening to help you understand the signs and symptoms, how to respond, that kind of thing. The other thing is, and we're going to get into this coming up, is going to be one of the anniversaries of Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and I don't remember which one, and it really doesn't make a difference. All I can tell you is that Katrina is still not whole. I mean, that the New Orleans is still not whole because of that natural disaster. And so we want to be mindful of that, because since then, there have been many other natural disasters in this country that have not been responded to. And so we want to make sure that we at least use that as a thoughtful point of how do we prepare ourselves for future disasters in this country. And last but not least, you know, I've been telling you since that man came into office and occupies the highest office in the land, is that we need to make sure we don't give up our vote, we don't give up our voice, and we definitely don't give up our dollars. You know, those are the three things we have, still have some agency over, although some days it doesn't seem like we have a lot, particularly over the bucks in our pocket. But, and I also been telling you to find your people, because this is a time that we need to really be connecting with community, and we need to be using that community not only to make sure we have what we need, but as part of our healing process over time. So over the weekend, I was able to go to the Lee Cleetown annual picnic, where Brother Red has been organizing that since 1999. And that was just a wonderful gathering with DJ Clean Cut playing the music. But it was a time where people been connecting, because that was once a community that they were a part of. It doesn't exist anymore, but they are still trying to keep the community together. So that's exactly an example of what I've been talking about. Find your people, because you're going to need them going forward. So because it is Black Commentator Roundtable, there are a few areas that we want to touch on, and one of them is going to be the civility of this country at this point in time. And so I'm going to give some examples of that, and then I really would like for us to go to talking about the war and the economy, because sometimes I don't think when we connect the dots, people see the war as something that affects them, except at the pump or in their pocketbooks. And we want to do a little bit more doubling down than that. And then lastly, I really want to talk about, because we are on the edge of talking about Labor Day, I want us to talk about the role of the labor movement in the current pro-democracy movement. And so those are the two big things. And so we may have David Love joining us, but right now we have Elwood joining us and Bill Fletcher. And so I always start off by saying, what have you written lately, so that people can zero in on that. And I know, Elwood, you got a whole nother platform now, Elwood in the Kitchen. So give us a little bit about that, and then tell us what you've written so far that would be of interest to our listeners and our viewers.
Yes, Jamala, thank you. Have a newsletter on Substack. It's entitled Elwood's Kitchen, Always Sizzling. And we have each week, I try to do a weekly column, sometime maybe bi-weekly, but I talk about usually most of the time current events, what's happening in the culture right now. My latest column was on Milo Yiannopoulos. He was actually the far-right provocateur who was just recently deported by ICE and the Trump administration. He's back in Great Britain now, his native Great Britain. Well, he's from Greece, but he grew up in Britain primarily. But anyway, he's there in Britain, and he was talking about, he said, you know, how he resented, now he really resents Trump, supporting Trump. He was a person who was so pro-ICE and so deportation, and then he himself is the very person who ends up getting deportated. I said, you know, how ironic, you know, that is. And how, you know, maybe you know, not so much Schadenfreude, but you know how much, you know, it's kind of almost for his detractors, the people he always went after, it was probably a delicious irony, you know, in many ways.
Yeah, I would say karma.
Karma. But that's what I put down. I put that in a piece too. I said karma and justice. But I feel that that was my latest piece. But I write about topics like that. Right before that, I did write a piece on Dolly Parton and her impact with her relationship with people. Particularly, I had a segment of it on the Black community, because a lot of people don't really realize how involved she was in the Black community, like with HBCUs and a lot of times those costumes and things like that, with those, you know, those bands that they did as well. A lot of those, you know, clothes and things that a lot of them were quietly paid for by Dolly Parton. People didn't even know it, you know.
I talked about that last week on the show, Dolly Parton and her relationship to Black Lives Matter and to the Black people, period. Bill, what have you written about lately? I'm going to say one thing, because I know how you write.
You know how I write.
Yeah, like two or three columns a day.
Well, there's a couple things I wrote a few weeks ago that I'll mention. One is a piece on the film The Odyssey, and something that's been completely overlooked in most of the mainstream, which is that it was filmed in part in the occupied sections of Western Sahara. And so I... which is an issue, Jamala, that Black America doesn't discuss. For all of the Pan-Africanist BS that people run, they don't talk about Western Sahara. So I wrote about that, and I wrote this other a book review about an excellent book called Confronting Zionism that is coming out in November through Haymarket Press. And the book review was, both of these pieces were published in Zenit. And I hope people will look at the review, but most especially go buy the book.
Yeah.
It's a very good analytical piece that helps one understand the construction of Zionism.
Yeah, and I think we need to know more of that, because we sometimes get confused when somebody calls us anti-Semitic because we're talking
right.
about Zionism. We get all defensive, just like we do with the whole notion of, socialism and democratic socialism, communism. They all get thrown together, and then people don't understand what's what, and the lines of demarcation, because they're very distinct in that way. So yeah. So speaking of book reviews, I have one coming out on BlackCommentator.com whenever they come back off a hiatus, which I think is going to be the 9th or the 10th. But I'm doing a review on, or I've done a review on, a book called The Zorg by Siddharth Khara. And he's done this incredible research on the ship, the Zorg, and its relationship to the abolition of slavery in Britain. Very, very intriguing. And so actually he'll be on the show Voices from the Battlefield on the 16th. So that's something that, again, that's a good book. When we talk about like books that we want to recommend to people to read, that's one as well. So I want to jump right into what I see is this accumulation of attacks on the democracy, and all of us have been writing about this and in many ways involved in pro-democracy activities. But, I just kind of put them all to some of them together to give people a sense of what we're doing. And I always remind people that we have a pathological liar in the White House, a two-count impeached person. Two-time impeached person, but we also have a government that, from Doge until the present, that major defunding and cutoffs of critical staff has meant that we are operating literally with our hands behind our back. And so when you cut off like major people who have the institutional memory of some of these agencies and departments, from FDA to the military to human services, what you have is a non-functioning government. And I think a lot of those folks were eliminated because they would represent the checks and balances for the current administration, because they know when these people are overstepping their bounds and they actually know what to do about it. They're gone now. We also have, in terms of corruption, and we've seen more corruption with this particular president than we've seen before. We know there's corruption, and I think the American people kind of let some corruption go because they think that's a part of the system, which it is not. But you have all this inside trading, you have the pay to play, you have national parks and other protected lands that are being given over to private developers. We now have a $40 trillion debt, national debt, because this president doesn't understand economics or pretty much nothing else. He's the tariffs and even the war, have resulted in, farmers losing farms, this whole foreclosures. We're looking at a immigration policy that's out of control, where innocent citizens are being killed by ICE. And definitely the whole notion of rounding up dangerous criminals, we know that that's not the fact, because we've seen the people that have been rounded up and who they represent, and that's another lie. So all this to say, the other thing is that we got a president who thinks he can rename countries and bodies of waters with a Sharpie and an executive order. So obviously, people like Canada, who's a trading partner and longtime ally of the U.S., have pretty much said, we understand that we're not dealing with the same U.S. that we're used to dealing with. So we're going to pursue a different kind of direction. And I think most people who observe this man's operation know that he's delusional. And so you can't interact with somebody that's delusional. But meanwhile, our democracy is being impacted. So what I want us to talk about is, how do we restore credibility, integrity, and confidence in the government? Or should we even be trying? Should we say, let them take this whole thing down and we'll start anew? But people are looking at this stuff and thinking, we'll never be the same. And maybe we shouldn't be the same. But with all of the destruction that's happening, I'm talking about physical and policy destructions around the, democratic institutions. What are we saying to the people around us, giving them some hope or giving them some avenues where there are things that still can be done to slow down this process? That this is, and I think we have to do that in some ways, even for our own sanity. But with all this going on, how are we going to restore some sanity and some credibility?
Is that what you're asking?
That's the question we got in front of us.
I would say one of the things we have to do is, like anything else, it's going to be having a reconstruction of sorts. I mean, that's what the term itself implies and means. And right now, it's going to, a lot of times things are obviously get worse before they get better in many ways. And we're going through a very, very trying and challenging time here in the United States. And this does not mean the nation has not had challenging times before. We certainly have. So, I mean, this is not anything new. We are going to have to be vigilant. I think there's going to have to be people who are willing to say enough is enough, like it was during the Revolutionary War with the Boston Tea Party. I mean, we don't know really historically what it takes sometimes. Anything, people are surprised what it takes people to really get offset and to get them going. Who would have thought during the Boston Tea Party it would have been tea that would have got people upset? No taxation or representation, start throwing tea into the harbor. And then from then on, the rebellious streak continued until America got its independence. So anything, I think America right now is getting closer and closer with these gas prices and others it's going to be something that I believe personally is going to be one specific thing that's going to get people across the political spectrum really, really upset and really, really angry. And they're all going to say, we may not agree politically on a lot of things, but we all agree about this. And I think that will get people mobilized. And then I think that is a movement, whether it's environmental, whether it's racial, whether it's gender, whatever the case may be, political, it's going to be financial, whatever. It's going to be something I think that's going to really just really set a fuse among a lot of Americans. And I think then we're going to see the beginning of the, revolution of the 21st century.
And that will be televised. And so for you, Bill, all of this and how we continue to keep people engaged when all the efforts are to chill, engagement of folks by various means. And then even the ability to do critical thinking when we got all of this intentional disinformation, all this AI generated stuff that just keep people like saying, just forget it. I don't know what's what out here. How do we cut through all of that?
So first, Jamala, we got to start with the solution to this is going to be the removal of Trump from office and the complete and total political destruction of MAGA. And anything short of that would be, in effect, the partial removal of a cancer and the hope that it will go away. And I think we all know better than that. So in agreement, we are talking about ultimately some sort of reconstruction. But I think it's important for folks to appreciate that part of the way we got ourselves, those of us that are not fascists, that got ourselves into this, is that we had a really wrong sense of history. And we had a very unilateral, unidirectional idea that history inevitably moves towards progress and that there may be some ups and downs and curves, but it's always going in one direction. And the idea that there could be a reversal has completely dismayed millions of people who never conceived. I mean, just think of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. For decades, we were told it will never happen, never. And that all that we needed to do was to fight the right in the courts, and it will never happen. And as a result, a wrong strategy was pursued. You know, the right pursued a two-level strategy of lawsuits plus changing state laws so that when the Supreme Court would ultimately overturn Roe v. Wade, right? Excuse me. It would automatically set things into motion. Much of the pro-choice movement basically said, well, we don't have to worry about that because the court's not going to reverse it. So
it's a constitutional amendment.
That's right. Well, mm-hmm. it wasn't, but it was a decision that for decades was held as a viable precedent, but it wasn't a constitutional amendment. And so there's a lot of dismay out there. And that's part of what we're up against. The people, many people are dismayed. And each time that the megalomaniac in the White House does something, we're just, it's like people say, when is he going to be stopped? And the answer to that is completely political. I mean, short of something happening to him, it's all about politics and the fact that the Republican Party consolidated as a hard right-wing party and lives in fear of him, and they happen to be the majority in both houses. And that's what we got to keep in mind. And that's why what happens in November and going forward is so important. And Trump realizes that, which is why he's trying to undermine the election.
Absolutely. We've just been joined by David Love. Glad you could join us, David. Right now we're talking about how do we take all the confusion and madness that's been happening for the last 18 months or so and make sense of it so that there's some credibility restored, democracy is restored, and the people prevail. And so that's what we've been talking about. And I just wanted to say to Bill's point about the amendment, in some states it became a constitutional amendment. Like in Missouri, we made it a constitutional amendment, but guess what? The state legislators just said, no, it's not gonna happen. And so what we're seeing is even with the ballot initiatives where we see that the majority of people support a particular issue, you have state legislators that say, no, that's not gonna happen. And so we're dealing with that, for example, with the ballot initiative, the whole notion of a ballot initiative and the right for citizens to use that as a tool of democracy. And so these people still are running roughshod over stuff, but I think the analogy of it being likened to a cancer is something that most people can understand, because if you don't cut out all the cancer, the rest of the organs metastasize, and then you have death. And so there's no way you can get out of a stage four cancer. So that's what we've been talking about, David. Do you have some insights on how do we restore credibility to what looks like for a lot of people, both inside and outside this country, is a dying democracy?
Yes. Well, I'm sorry that I missed the beginning of the conversation, but, you know, I'll just jump right in. There is a quote that has been on my mind this week that I shared with my students, and it is from bell hooks. Dominant parties maintain power by the threat, acted upon or not, that abusive punishment, physical or psychological, will be used whenever the hierarchical structures in place are threatened. So I believe that what we're dealing with now, I mean, in addition to what Bill has said, some of which I heard, I believe in many ways is a reckoning, and this desire to go back to the old hierarchies, the so-called good old days when people of color, Black folks, women, LGBTQ folks, and others knew their place. One thing that I want to add to the picture is that increasingly over the years, and it wasn't just in the era of Trump, but even before that, we have seen the growth of a system of government that is not accountable to the wishes of the people. And I believe that part of that is the role of money in electoral politics, and the fact that, you know, you have vast majorities of people, Democrats, independents, and even a sizable proportion of Republicans who are in favor of universal health care. We're the only, you know, so-called industrialized advanced country that doesn't have it. And yet you have people such as Hakeem Jeffries and other establishment Democrats going around and saying that they are not in favor of it. It is socialism. And what if it was socialism? that's another story. But in any case, the threat is definitely coming from the conservatives, the Republicans, the fascists, if you will. But I think we also have to look at the ways in which the moderates, the liberals that Dr. King and Malcolm X talked about, those who, you know, actually prefer to cooperate with the fascists than work with the progressives, the socialists, the left, and others.
Yeah, I wish we had time, but maybe for the next BC roundtable, we talk about what's going on inside the Democratic Party, because it seems like it's a little bit of cannibalism going on, but there's certainly some red baiting going on. But yeah, I'm gonna move us to like this whole war and what it means for our economy, what it means for our psyche. One of the things, and Bill and I talked about this some years ago, and he really made me come to the realization that we really haven't had a war that was justified, meaning that it was in defense of the country. Mainly the wars have been in acquisition of land and resources or to destabilize government so that we can capture their resources. And so I thought about that a lot when we were dealing with the whole Iran war. And this become an endless war, and a war that we don't even know how much it's costing. I've seen estimates as high as $116 billion, or like over literally $2 billion a day. But nobody seems to know how much, because they don't have to count, because it's so much money that the Pentagon gets. And now we have all this money that ICE has gotten, which is an arm of the state. And so we're seeing like billions and billions of dollars being sucked into a war, both a domestic war and a foreign war. And so for me, it's really trying to get people to understand what war means on their everyday lives. And it just seems like sometimes we said, yes, I pay taxes and they're doing it in my name, but I can't deal with that because I'm dealing with this stuff that's on my head right now, not even understanding that part of what's on your head right now is directly related to the wars that we have in other countries. The other thing I keep thinking about is with the way that P.P. Hesburgh has totally like obliterated the leadership, the seasoned leadership of the military, we are now at risk. I'm talking about national security risk. Everyday citizens are being attacked or whatever because these folks don't know what they're doing. So they're putting us in harm's way. So what about the wars that the U.S. engages in, and how do we get ourselves more sophisticated about understanding them so that every time they say, oh, we've been attacked, we need to get more money in the Pentagon, that we don't like rush? Because that's really what happened after 9/11. We had like the whole notion of the Patriot Act, which almost everybody in Congress said, yes, 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 let's do this. And now we have almost what I perceive as a police state right here in our own country, giving up civil liberties and all of that. And under the name of, you know, national security, keep our freedoms and all of that, you know, BS. So just how do we cut through even that BS to say that, yes, there's true national threats in the world, but people will tell you it's the U.S. that's the biggest threat to democracy around the world and not these other like smaller countries. So when I see them still doing target practice with little Caribbean boats and acting like somehow this is about national security, I just get furious. So Leo, let's just talk about that for a minute. Like what is up with these wars and these endless wars and the draining of our economy to sustain them?
It's the military-industrial complex, primarily. That's what it is. And there are Democrats and Republicans who make money off these wars, okay? So it's not a partisan thing. The Pentagon, they told them about 20 years ago that the Pentagon told them they did not need any more new machines or missiles. They said, guess what? You're going to get them anyway. So they got them. And I mean, trillions of dollars go into our defense budget every year. Trillions, not billions, trillions. A fraction of that money could take care of healthcare, education, safety net, social security, and everything else. It's about greed, and it's about the military industrial complex. And like I said, politicians across the political spectrum who are making money off those, off these wars. And that's what it that's it is primarily what it's about. It's by greed and self-interest.
And so, Bill, how do we deal with like telling people, yes, they're greedy, they're stealing money, they're doing all of this, but yet we still have to have defense of the country? And so, the average person wants to be in the know and wants to know how their money is being spent, but it seems like it's getting more and more obscure about like where the money is, who's going. I mean, really, ICE got. And to Elwood's point, they got more money in that budget that could definitely deal with some social ills, but yet they're going to kill American citizens or round up American citizens or have detention concentration camps for American citizens. Where do we draw the line?
Well, first of all, it's amazing what people will put up with if they come to believe that there actually is a threat or that something in their lives is going crazy. There's a scene at the end of one of my favorite films, 3 Days of the Condor, that Cliff Robertson and Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. And I won't tell you what the film is about, but people need to watch it. But at the end, the CIA agent is saying to Robert Redford, he says something like, when people start becoming cold, losing fuel, finding food more difficult to reap, to obtain, they're going to want us to get it for them. They're not going to ask how or where. They're going to ask. And I thought that was, this is something that came out in 1975.
Yeah, long
I thought
time.
it was very, very, it remains very prescient because what the far right does, and not just the far right, is that they create this atmosphere of fear and suggest that there is a threat that must be taken care of militarily. For Ronald Reagan, it was the idea that the Sandinistas in Nicaragua were going to march north through Mexico and invade Texas. Now, any of us, right, we can sit back and laugh at this, but millions of people in the United States thought, wow, maybe that's true. These boats that have been attacked with no proof, no evidence of any kind of threat, but there's a deferral to the Department of Defense to saying, well, they know more than we do. They know what they're doing. So part of what we have to do is what you were saying. We have to do what I've been calling a kind of political literacy training, mass training. We have to get people to to understand how to do critical thinking,
Yes.
how to research things, how to verify stuff, and not just going for the okey-doke. But the other thing I want to say, which may or may not seem related, is this, Jamala. A lot of people misunderstood Trump when it came to foreign policy. And I remember there is a black left-wing online magazine that will shall go nameless that published a piece back in 2016 that said that Trump was a closet peace candidate. And when I read that, I went back and forth between falling out of my chair and laughing hysterically, right? But this is where, because the people that wrote this aren't stupid, this is where it comes from. It comes from a misidentification of the notion of isolationism and the misuse of that term. So Trump was identified as an isolationist, and it happened again in his campaign in 2024 when he said, no more eternal wars. Isolationism in US history has never meant isolationism.
No.
It's never meant autarky. It's meant primarily we do not want to be bound by international law and we don't want to be involved in Europe. But it's never meant stay out of Latin America. It's never meant stay out of Africa. It's never meant stay out of Asia, right? And so when Trump would sound like a quote unquote isolationist, people were missing this. This man simply did not want constraints by international law, multilateral agreements. He wanted transactional relationships. And as became clear, he wanted to reassert US domination over the Western Hemisphere. He was prepared to cut deals, almost like the book 1984, cut deals with other powers to divide up the planet. The question is whether people in the United States are prepared to accept that, because accepting that means that there will be eternal wars, because the idea that the United States will dominate the Western Hemisphere forever ultimately will mean military force, whether it's against Canada, Greenland, Mexico, Colombia, or whoever else. It will necessitate that. So the question to the people of the United States is, at what point are you going to convince the people of the world that we are not idiots? That's the question for the people of the United States.
And so, David, if we use that as a premise and not want to use the fear part as the whipping board, because we could also drum up fear about what it means for this country to do all the devilment they do across the world and put ourselves at risk for, quote, terrorist attacks, whatever. And even when Americans go abroad, they are sitting targets because of the whole anti-American sentiment that other people think, oh, you all are letting these people do, your government do this, when most people are oblivious about what we do across this globe. What other methodologies could we use to convince people that we understand foreign policy and we understand war? We are going to hold our elected officials accountable.
Well, one thing that makes me hopeful is that in this war, majority of people are not buying it, as in past wars, yep. You know, like Vietnam, you know, after 9/11, Iraq war, where you had maybe 80% approval, but now you have 80% disapproval, because I think people are starting to draw those lines. I don't think they're drawing them fully, which is why I agree with Bill that we do need some sort of critical thinking process and sort of political education to provide people. I think people have to understand the link between the militarism at home and the militarism abroad. The fact that, you know, the military industrial complex, the surveillance state, all this technology that we're using on to kill brown children over there, coming back, and ICE is using it on people here, and people have to draw those connections, and I think that's very important. And also, to the extent that we are spending vast amounts of our resources wasting it on war, that is money that can't be used for programs of social uplift, for health, welfare, education, and all of those other things. And I have to believe that people are starting to see the connections. But one other thing that I want to mention, because you had talked about Hegseth and the damage that he's causing to the military, I find it ironic that the one key tool, instrument for the empire, they can't even get that right. They're starting to dismantle their own military, the institution that they love and care about so much. One could say that that was the only true institution that was a meritocracy in this country, or at least came close to that. And now they're even undermining that because they don't want Black people, queer people, women, and others to have leadership. Not that I have a vested interest in a diversified military, you know, empire.
I hear you.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah. And I think about that often, because when I'm starting to formulate a response to somebody, I'm sounding like I'm all for this BS, but I'm not. But at the same time, if we had a nation that was truly a democracy, that was really about protection of the shores, protection of people, as opposed to aggression, we may have a different idea. Because one of the things that happened with the Lincoln when people started to hear about how they were being treated, it goes back to your point, David, like this is supposed to be the sacred kind of department, and why would they not be treated? In fact, why aren't they getting food and supplies when all this money that's going to the Pentagon is, I would say, trillions, and our people are not being fed? So I immediately started to contact people that I knew were on boats, ships, the Gulf War and everything else, and they never experienced anything like what the Lincoln is doing. So when people are looking at that, they're wondering, wait a minute, you calling these people your most sacred like folks, yet you treating them like this? So I'm expecting that at some point in time there's going to be some rebellions inside those arms of military, and probably already has, because remember the guy that first sounded the alarm about the Lincoln? Well, now he's being punished and penalized to the point that he's going to get half a salary because he said, I can't do this anymore, I'm about to go crazy. And now, instead of getting him help, he's getting punished. So this is like, you know, resonating with people in the military, like, okay, is this what you think of us? So this is something that we got to keep an eye on, because I think that the more unrest that we see domestically and even in the armed forces, that the repression is going to be that much harder and harsher. In a few minutes that we have left, and as we approach Labor Day, and the fact that, you know, the labor movement has definitely been under attack, and sometimes the internal struggles have caused them to be the external attacks to be more successful than less successful. What role are they playing in the current pro-democracy movement in terms of having access to, in many unions, thousands of people, yet they don't seem to have the impact that some of us would like for them to have? And I'm going to start with Bill on that, because he was a active member of a lot of these unions, and not just as a rank and file, but, you know, in the administrative parts. So, you know, I think about the AFL-CIO, where you were doing the education piece, and I'm wondering if that is still even in existence, because I don't see much coming out that's helping workers understand the period that we're in now.
So, you know, the short answer, Jamal, is that the trade union movement has been very slow to move. It has been reluctant to identify the nature of the enemy. It was prepared to criticize Trump, criticize Musk. Eventually, they started talking about authoritarians. They almost never talk about fascism. They almost never recognize that we're not up just against a megalomaniac, but we're up against a mass social movement that represents millions of people. And in part, the failure to recognize this, I think, reflects that within the ranks of the trade union movement, there are differences. There is a MAGA part of the trade union movement, certainly not the majority, but it's there and it's very vocal. And you have a lot of cowardly leaders who are thinking, if I speak up, I may lose my next election. Well, fool, there may not be a next election if these people win, right? But nevertheless, that is part of what's going on. And it's certainly part of what we in Standing for Democracy have been trying to address, but it's been very hard, because even some of our own allies, progressives, have wanted to take, or as Candace would say, hit the easy button. You know, take it slow. You don't want to upset too many people. Eventually they'll get it. Let's not talk about too many complicated issues. There was a study I just read that you have that came out just recently that was saying that most union members want their unions to be actively involved in the fight for democracy. They actively, right? They are, most union members are frustrated that their leaders aren't doing more. So, you know, I feel like we're on the right side of history. And unfortunately, too many of our colleagues are just still waiting for the sign.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, Elwood, that a number of these unions, except for maybe the trade unions, are Black and brown, and particularly Black and brown women. And so it seems to be like a sexist sort of racist piece in here about, okay, this is the rake and file, but I'm going to listen to the vocal white MAGA folks, which are a minority in these unions, over the hundreds or maybe thousands of members that are black and brown. How should union members be responding to that kind of leadership?
Well, unions have always been complex by their very nature. They have certainly done some wonderful things for the, you know, for working class people and working people as well. But unions are not without racism, sexism, you know, anti-Semitism and homophobia. Those things exist in those unions as well. People, they have those, even no matter how minimal, they still exist. And what you see there and on many levels is a tendency to a lot of those unions, people, they may pay their dues, but you got to realize they have bosses and they have, you know, boards of directors and everything else. And a lot of those people are in conjunction with the politicians. So we got to realize too, you know, that's where, you know, they have to take their listening. We got to realize too, some of them have to take, or they certainly, they want some of that money to continue to come through or to be sustained or not be targeted as a union. They can't always just do every single thing they want. They have to be compromised themselves. That's why I say unions, like anything else, are compromised. Yes, unions can do some good work, but it can also be compromised as well. I mean, our whole system right now, there's, you know, I'm not saying everybody's up for sale, but the point is there are.
But how about everybody's got a price?
Well, and I think that could be the that could be the same with some unions. Remember back in 1984 with the Teamsters, who was the Teamsters union back, Ronald Reagan. Now, he was doing everything he could to you know, slash auto industry and everything else, and a bunch of other things. So my point is that politicians, we're in a society, in a capitalist society, you know, nothing's going to be totally pure. And on another note, we had mentioned one time, I do want to say we do have to be, with terminology and things, we do have to be careful how we label things. Because I do think, like, when terms like when you say defund the police and those type of things like that as well, a lot of people, even people of color, listen to that and it really turns them off in a sense, because they don't know. Defunding the police, people think when you say defund, it means to take away, you know, to reduce. And reform the police would have been much better, you know, to reform the police. I don't think anybody would have been too upset with that. But when you start using terms like defund the police and those type of things, even with people of color and even mainstream people, working class people, those things are alarming to hear those kind of terms. Or, you know, we should get rid of all jails and, and it's one thing to say, I want to get rid of, like Angie Nixon herself said, I'm not against getting rid of jails. She goes, I want to get rid of for-profit prisons. That's what you got to be specific about. But you just can't come out and say, you know, get rid of jails, defund the police without any kind of explanation, because those kind of things will turn people, even progressive people who consider themselves progressive minded people, that's not going to endear them to your agenda.
And I would say I'm a big proponent of using terminology and educating people so that they understand what it means, because it's the same thing that we had to do with socialism and communism. Like, they would say, that means you're going to be like these bureaucratic Russians, or we're not going to have any democracy. And he's like, okay, then what other term do you want to use for that? So the times when I've used defund the police, and I've used both of those terms to educate people, when you start to talk about it, they understand what it meant. Because the people that are most opposed to it are the pro-police folks, because they know what that means for them and their livelihood. And so I want to go to David about what the labor movement now, have they kept in pace with the changing economy and where workers are? I mean, we've long passed the whole industrial place where workers were at the point of production. Are unions being creative enough about where and how to organize workers so that their unions are stronger and their mission is fortified because they have members that understand what the mission is? And I would also say that in many cases, I find unions the same as politicians in that they want to keep the engagement of members to a minimum so that they could do what they need to do, and they're not really wanting like full participation, full members voting, because at a certain point they might be voted out. And so so they've replicated, you know, some of the structures in society that we've been like opposed to forever. So yeah, so how do we deal with that, David?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one thing that I'll say is that obviously there have been a lot of changes in the economy, transition to more of a service economy with service jobs. And I think it's necessary for the labor movement to catch up. You know, one thing that I'll say is that as an academic, I'm happy to see how faculty unions are developing and springing up. I'm a proud member of the American Federation of Teachers and the American Association of University Professors, who made their first endorsement, political endorsement of Abdul El Sayed for this senatorial race in Michigan. I think that that's an example of the types of positions that unions should take. And also, I think it's important for unions to look at themselves as part of the greater community, getting involved, acting in solidarity with community groups. And I think eventually the unions have to, those who haven't already, need to get together with people who are on the street, in the streets, working to try to secure our rights. And, you know, ultimately it's going to mean a lot of strategizing, looking at things differently, and not just staying in their silos.
Right. You know, I think we could talk about this for a long time, because I really, as a former union member myself, just looking at the union that I was a part of now being proponent of a data center. And I know a number of unions have like support data centers as, quote, where the jobs are going to be, when all we know is that those jobs are very temporary, like they're construction. And then once the construction is over, now what? So so I've been disappointed in that. But at the same time, that's one issue. And I think if we look at like the totality of the role that labor has played in issues, whether it be like the 8-hour workday, Social Security, all of that is based on organized labor and organizing workers to fight for those issues. I got one more question for y'all as we end, and I'll make it quick, but people want to know, how are you all staying sane and healthy in this environment based on what you do? And I'm going to start with me. What, in addition to like meditation and journaling, I've started learning how to curse in sign language. There's a black guy named Chad on Instagram who's teaching how to cuss and sign. And so when I'm throwing up my signs, y'all, it's not gang signs. I'm cussing somebody out. So that's what I've been doing. And it's been fun learning. Bill, what are you doing to stay sane?
Writing novels.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Right. And, you know, writing murder mysteries.
Yeah.
And I strongly recommend it.
And you should be having some news for us soon, right? About some movie,
I hope so.
Rights.
Oh, yeah. Lord. Yeah. The third David Gomes novel will hopefully be out later this year, early 2027, and I'm starting to work on a fourth, but not a fourth David Gomes. It's a completely different story.
Okay. Yeah. That does sound fun, but I haven't leaped into that yet. What about you, Elwood? What's keeping you sane?
Well, I do a lot of exercise. I do hot power yoga. I do a lot of that.
Okay.
And I do, you know, when I can, I like to do like hip hop dance classes and things of that nature. And my writing just keeps me. I'm a professor, so you know, I'm always interacting with students, you know, all those levels. So those, you know, a combination of all those type of things keep me, you know, just, you know, keep me, you know, going steady going.
Okay, David, what are you doing?
Well, I'll agree with Elwood. I mean, interacting with students, that is cathartic for me. Writing also. And I'll also say hiking and walking for miles at a time to clear my mind, cleanse my mind and spirit and all that, because we're dealing with a lot of madness these days, and it's important to, you know, sort of maintain and just,
And yeah, and I think it's especially important for people like us because we are the trusted messengers, and people often come to us like, what do we do? What are we supposed to be doing? And if our heads are not clear and if our hearts are not pure, we're going to be swept away like everybody else is, as opposed to being that pole of sanity. And so, yeah, so I often like ask people like, what are they doing to stay sane? Because that's what often gets asked of me. How do you stay sane with all this turmoil around you? But somebody's got to keep the ship steady, and it's people like us. But we still have to take care of ourselves, and we still have to look for community help us take care of ourselves. So, having said that, thank you, my brothers from BlackCommentator.com. Go to that website, see what the latest writings are. Also, they come back offline off of summer break September 10th. So check that out. And just keep reading, as all of us have said. Keep reading, and in some cases writing, and start with just journaling. Just getting your thoughts down there. That's cathartic, and I think healthy. But yeah, I really appreciate you all coming on. I know you all got busy schedules, but y'all's views are very important to the people who listen to this show. So thank you for coming on.
Pleasure.
Yeah,
take care.
Thank you.
Yes, this is Jamal Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. If you want to check this show out or any other previous shows, go to jamalrogers.com. And the videos are up on the YouTube channel. So yeah, check those out.
Good.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. You've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the fighting.